Okay, philosophy lecture. Philosophy lecture number, what is it, 7? I think it's philosophy lecture number 7. Yeah, philosophy lecture number 7. Just remember now, next week's lectures, we're going to have the philosophy lectures will start a couple hours early. And only two lectures on, we're only going to have two lectures on New Testament survey from 11:30 to 1:30, and then from 1:30 to 3:30, we'll have these two. That's for the Gospel Fest. Take a look at, we're still in epistemology. John, tell me what epistemology is, what branch of philosophy?
Study of knowledge.
Okay, there we go. It deals with knowledge. And so now what you'll need to look at is chapter 8. Chapter 8, which tries to answer the question, is certainty possible? Is certainty possible? What if we answered that question, certainly not?
You refute yourself.
Right. You would refute yourself. If you answer the question, probably not, then there would be no refutation. Or if you answer the question, certainly yes, that wouldn't be self-refuting, but I think you could refute it from other areas. So is certainty possible? And we want to look at that, but first there's different kinds of certainty. Again, you can open up your book to 120 if you want. You could just highlight or you could take notes, whatever you feel more comfortable with. But the question is certainty possible is what we're looking at now. We're in the field of epistemology, philosophical branch deals with knowledge and how man knows. Remember that we already answered the question, can man know? And we found that, yeah, man can know some things, because to say man cannot know is to claim to know that man cannot know. So man can know something. And then we started asking the question, how can we know? We talked about different ways of knowing, like rationalism and empiricism. And so now we want to say, well, since man can we know with certainty? Different kinds of certainty. There's apodictic certainty. And this is the highest standard for certainty. Okay? It requires the necessary truth of its object. Well, he brings up some other terms here. To know something with indubitability would mean that there's no total exclusion of doubt. Okay? Indubitability, you know, just remember the word doubt, because the form of the word doubt is in there, and it's saying that it's just basically saying it's beyond doubt. Incorrigibility means it's incapable of being corrected or amended. But apodictic certainty is basically saying the highest degree of certainty, you know it with complete certainty. Okay? Now, psychological certainty that just deals with the person's psychology, the person's subjective beliefs. And all that says is that that's when the knower feels certain. It's like John feels certain that he knows that. We have this all the time. I'm certain that those classes begin at 11:30. Okay? So it's when the knower feels certain. Conventional certainty conventional certainty, that's attained by consulting a dictionary or an authority on the subject in question. For instance, because of conventional language, we have defined a bachelor as an unmarried male. Because of the rules of football, a field goal is worth 3 points. Okay? So we can be certain about those. There are things that are pretty much true by definition within a certain... true by definition within a certain rule book, okay? Like a dictionary is a rule book for a language. The rules of the games of the game of football would be another rule book.
So this in this category would come things like we know that Saturn is made up of such and such gas because scientists have told us that, and that's how I'm sure.
I would say if you view science more as a game, like you can conventionally know it by modern science defines something as something, you can know that, what they define it as it, but whether it really exists as that in that way and in that fashion, that brings a whole other rate, because then you're dealing with things, can you be certain about the existence of the external world and things like that. So
I would have psychological certainty in that case, because I've orbited Saturn.
And then sometimes during my sermons on Sunday, I know pragmatic certainty, conventionally, it's more like, by conventional, they mean like, it's like somebody's, there are rules that everybody's accepted.
Well, where I was trying to go with this is people who say that they're certain that man evolved. People just know that, you know. They think that they just know it, and where's that coming from?
That would be beyond this, because that's like certain things within science, like a scientific method, an agreed upon method, agreed upon rules of the game.
Sure.
Those you can know with conventional certainty, but as far as once you start dealing with sense data, then you've opened up a whole other can of worms, because there's still questions like, does an external world outside our mind really exist? If it does, can we know it? You know, so that brings up a whole other... But the conventional certainty is, if certain rules have been agreed upon, we can know those rules with certainty, that type of thing.
I think that would fall in the category of bias, continuity, certainty.
Then there's pragmatic. Whenever you hear pragmatism, means that if it works, it's true, or if it works, it's right. Things along those lines. Pragmatic certainty, we are certain of our beliefs if they work. This, by the way, this would be more in tune with modern science, pragmatic certainty, because modern science, a lot of it is based on predictability. If they figured out their equations, their scientific equations, and if they figured it out in such a way where their goal was to get man on the moon, if they get man on the moon, they see that as enough proof to make them certain that their equations were correct if they did get man on the moon. Yet we found over and over again, there's sometimes when you use the old system of Ptolemy with
the spheres.
Yeah, well, when you use the old system, assuming that the Earth is the center of the solar system and the Sun revolves around the Earth, with that equation, certain things in certain areas, predictability is more successful than in those same areas with the Sun as the certain, as the center of the solar system and the Earth revolving around it. But it just so happens when you take all different areas that are around, it is much more, the predictability is much higher and everything makes much more sense with the sun at the center, so we hold to that view. But there are some areas, some gray areas, where the old system used to work perfectly fine. And you see, the problem was, though, the predictability. They had to keep making further explanations to justify keeping the system. And then they said, well, we could get away with all these extra justifications if we just accept a different model. And that's what the creationist is arguing. You don't have to have exceptions to the law, the first and second laws of thermodynamics and the law of biogenesis and the cell theory and the Big Bang model. You don't have to have exceptions to all that if you just accept our model. It fits perfectly well with it without all these asterisks and extra explanations and stuff. But pragmatic certainty, we're certain of our beliefs if they work well. In fact, if you take a little bit of a disease, tiny bit of it, and you inject it into somebody's bloodstream, and then they don't get the disease while everybody around them is getting it, because it worked, we say, well, this way that we've immunized this person, it must be true. And so in that way, you can see science, because it works, is assumed to be true. And a lot of times, though, they've done test cases where they just gave water to cows and have had just as much success, just as high a rate of success. And so sometimes it makes you wonder. But then there's probability. Which is trying to take it pretty much out of the realm of certainty, really. And what it says is that some believe certainty to be impossible and settle for probability. Now again, to say that certainty is certainly possible, we can be certain that certainty is impossible, that self is self-refuting. But to say that certainty is probably impossible for us at this point, there's nothing self-refuting about that. That's kind of the position I hold. Because human minds have failed in the past, because we really thought somebody was trying to murder us and then we woke up from a bad dream, it's always possible that tonight we're going to wake up from a bad dream and find out that, oh yeah, we're the only ones that exist. And this whole world of other beings was just a big thing that we dreamed up. So it's always possible that we could be mistaken. Because of this, we have to settle for a high degree of probability, not knowing things with probability. And that's the view that I hold. I think we can know things beyond reasonable doubt. There are certain things I think we could call self-evident truths that are... We know they're true, but we can't prove it with philosophical certainty.
Are you sure about that?
Well, I'm pretty certain, but...
He's probably certain.
Okay, well, let's take a look. But there are some areas where we can get the highest degree of certainty, but there are areas that don't tell us anything about the real world. For instance, self-definitional things like the axioms of geometry and things like that. Types of knowledge, and that's what we're going to get into now, a little bit as we deal with the different types of knowledge.
What do you mean self-definitional?
Well, like bachelors or unmarried males, it's true by definition. Doesn't tell us that there is any, that Kurt is a bachelor. Yeah. You have to... get to know her.
That's something about which we're not certain.
Okay. It doesn't have the highest degree of probability.
It's pragmatic. It works for you.
Types of knowledge. First off, moral commands. Geisler and Feinberg touch on that. Moral commands. Moral relativism teaches, you have moral relativism. You can have relativism, you can have epistemological, you can even call it metaphysical relativism. Relativism can be in different areas where when you deal with the whole realm of truth, relativism would say that there are no absolute truth. There is no absolute truth. Of course, if that statement is true, then that's an absolute truth that self-refutes. But you can also have it in the realm of morality, so it's moral relativism. Moral relativism is the view that ethical choices are arbitrary. They deny moral absolutes. What's right for you is right for you. It doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. Different cultures embrace different moral standards, they argue, and therefore each culture develops its own, or each individual develops his own. They deny moral deny moral absolutes. Absolutism, moral absolutism, teaches that there is a universal moral law, and that there's greater agreement between cultures than the moral relativist claim. For instance, all societies believe people are more important than things. Okay? Now, they don't always apply that as good as they should. Almost every society believes it's wrong to kill, to murder innocent children. Even ones who sacrifice children to gods just believe, well, the gods are more important than the children are deserving of the most precious things that we have. So disagreements about morality doesn't mean there is no correct view. Even Hitler believed it was right to kill the Jews. In other words, as ruthless as he was and as evil as he was to kill innocent Jewish people, he believed that there was such a thing as right and wrong, and it was right for him to try to accomplish his goals. And he believed that the best thing that the world could have is for the Aryan race to take it over. So even he had a little bit of morality, as warped as he was. Disagreements about morality does not mean there is no correct view. And if moral relativism is true, you can't even condemn the actions of Adolf Hitler. So we would hold that. So what I would just argue, though, is that just because we can't know with certainty what is right and what is wrong, and I'm speaking in a philosophical sense, by the way. We're going to get a little bit further here, and Geisler and Feinberg make some real important points. But we would, as Christians, would hold the moral that there are moral absolutes, but as far as is certainty possible, just because all mankind doesn't know them, but doesn't know exactly what each moral law is, and maybe applies the law in the wrong way, doesn't mean that moral relativism is true.
It'd be like stepping off the building and then gravity doesn't apply.
Yeah, and
or even if you weren't aware of the law of gravity, you'd step off the building and it takes you that 2 points.
Yeah, that's the dilemma of modern or postmodern man. There are no absolutes. And it's in the realm not just of morality, but in all truth. There are no absolute truths, yet the law of gravity is an absolute truth, and whatever science has found is absolutely true. And that's, you can't have it both ways. But even to say there are, I believe, an absolute morality, doesn't mean that what you're saying is that we can know it with total certainty. In fact, sometimes I even wonder how a lot of what Geisler are saying in this chapter, Geisler and Feinberg, doesn't seem like it would have done better in a different chapter. But another type of knowledge, but he just talked about different types of knowledge, and then we have to apply that question to each of these fields. But knowledge of the external world. I am writing on a board, at least I think I am. How do I know that the board exists? How do we know that our cars exist? Knowledge about the external world. Arguments for certainty. You have a rationalist like Rene Descartes. Rene Descartes, now he was the guy that tried to find something that he could not doubt, so he doubted everything, but the more he doubted, the more he recognized the existence of the doubter. And so he said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And from there, then he began to, he felt that he had reached this apodictic point of certainty, and he began to try to deduce everything from that. And his view pretty much came out that the external world must exist as the cause of his idea for the external world. He even argued, he used the ontological argument for God's existence, and argued that a good God would not deceive us, and therefore he makes us think in such a way that we think the external world exists. Therefore, the external world must exist. But he believed that we could be certain that the external world exists. Yes.
And that he said the external world must exist because I think it exists.
Because I have the idea of it, and that God, this idea that I have of it, all men have this idea of it, and God would not be deceiving us. Therefore, it must be true that the external world does exist.
So then how does that relate to when we have the idea of dragons and sea monsters and science fiction aliens and stuff that don't exist?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of problems with this. There are definitely a lot of problems with this view, but it would get more to, the differentiation between an idea that I've imagined, just thought up like a dragon, whereas an idea that I really feel convinced is true. So it's all kind of caught up in that. But believe me, there's very few, if anybody, who thinks that Descartes really proved this case. Modern man, the hyper-rationalists, they believe that Descartes was right, and they try to prove everything by reason. But that only led to postmodern man, who's given up on his attempt to find any truth. G.E. Moore, also under, he's an empiricist, believes you've got to find truth through the five senses.
Descartes is a rationalist?
Rationalist, yeah. Extreme rationalist. G.E. Moore is an empiricist. He says that my body is proof that an external world of physical objects exists. And, it's pretty much, he takes it as a given that my body definitely does exist. His senses aren't going to fool him in that area, but, our senses fool us in a lot of areas. Now, there's a lot of objections against certainty about the external world. All philosophers, except skeptics, believe in the existence of the external world. Still, most of them object to this knowledge being certain. Let me repeat that. Except for skeptics, all philosophers believe in the existence, the real objective existence of the external world. And the advice skeptics would be included in there, a lot of weird different philosophical groups that would see existence as only in their mind, or as existence only as ideas or whatever. But still, most philosophers object to this knowledge as being certain. David Hume said that since it is conceivable, and what he means by that is since it is rationally possible that nothing exists, the existence of the external world is not certain. Okay? It is rationally possible. See, to say 1 + 1 = 3, that's not rationally possible. By the way, 1 is defined, and by the way, 3 is defined. But to say nothing exists, that generates no contradiction. Now, let me say this, though. Nothing exists. Just to throw out some thoughts, I'm skeptical. I suspend judgment on this. But what he's saying is to say nothing exists is not a contradictory statement. Okay? However, you can phrase nothing exists in a way that it would be a contradictory statement. Because nothing means non-being. And to say that something exists means that it is being. Now, if you put nothing exists in that form, that non-being is being, guess what? It's an obvious contradiction. It's saying that non-A
yes.
equals A. So then if you put it in that way, it makes it rationally impossible that nothing exists. Now, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I could see that possibility. I'd like to see it argued out. Geisler would disagree with that
sure.
premise, but a lot of rationalists would probably agree with it. So I would like to see that argued out a little bit more.
Don't you have to, in order to say nothing exists, then you have to exist yourself in order to make that statement?
But that's a whole different thing. There you're going from...
Let's go back to Descartes.
Logical... No. The Descartes is in the realm of logical necessity or rational inescapability. It's going from that realm to actual undeniability. To say that it's actually undeniable that I exist is not saying that it's logically impossible that I not exist. They're totally different things. And it's always logically possible.
My brain just broke.
It's always logically possible. Okay, is
it... The logical arguments have no bearing at all on whether something actually is or isn't.
That's where the big debate is.
Okay.
Between the rationalist and more empirically minded people.
So we've got the possibility and the actuality of it. And those two arguments are carried on independently.
Well, Aquinas, Geisler, and most of the time myself, keep them separate.
Okay.
But there are some that do think that, for instance, if a guy thinks the ontological argument for God's existence does prove God's existence, he's saying that there is at least something that, if it can be proven that it's possible to exist, it must exist, and that is God. And he believes God's existence is logically necessary. And so he would see a point where the actual realm and the possible realm, there is some possible being, some being that must exist in
right.
the actual realm, and we can learn it from reason alone.
And that's what those two would learn?
Yeah, for some people. If it's true, it would definitely, but a lot of people doubt the effectiveness of that argument. But actual undeniability, to say that the possibility of John Gardner not existing, yeah, that is rationally possible.
Sure.
But it is still actually undeniable.
I do it back then.
That because you have to deny your existence, you have to actually exist to make the denial, because nothing can deny nothing.
Sure.
So it's actually undeniable that you exist, but it's not logically necessary that you exist. But some would say there is one being that part of its definition is existence.
But to the philosopher making them,
and that is God, you see.
I'll think about this.
Yeah.
Give you a question later.
Okay. And all I'm saying is this one thing where they always say is logically possible that nothing exists. That's the one possible open door. And Geisler agrees with that. It's logically possible that nothing exists. Well, that's the one open door to the ontological argument, I think, for God's existence, is that if you write nothing exists, you can write that as nothing means non-being, and that exists means that it's in being. So you can write it down as non-being is being, which obviously violates the law of non-contradiction, which would then say that something does exist. Something must logically exist. But the thing is, there might be, in this process, and I think Kant tried to respond to that type of thing, Immanuel Kant, in that process there might be an inserting of being in the possible realm inserting of actual being in the possible realm, which might not necessarily follow. In other words, it might be more of a problem with human language than actually a foul-proof argument. But I'm just saying, leave that door open. There is the possibility that there might be more strength to rationalism and more strength to the ontological argument for God's existence.
Well, I would think there would be strength to rationalism in the first place, because you look at just the history of man, what we've been able to accomplish through science by rational thought.
What is rationalism, though? Rationalism is not just rational thought. Pure rationalism would be that truth can be found through reason alone. All that. To try to prove God's existence from the existence of the world, you've left the realm of pure rationalism. Because you're in the actual world. Rationalism is just things, finding things that are, you know, definitely true. The problem with rationalism, Gordon Hart, really, one of the most rationalistic philosophers I've known, yet at the same time, Gordon Clark's argument that the failure of rationalism is mainly the fact that, where do you get your first principles from? And if you know them, you have to know them with certainty to deduce anything from them. But how can you know them with certainty without evidences for them? But if you have evidence for them, then they're not first principles. The evidence has got to be the first principle. But then how do you know them with certainty? And if there's evidence for them, then you end up with an infinite regress. So Gordon Clark argues, then therefore you have to presuppose something. But he just presupposes things, you know, the existence of God of Bible willy-nilly. I say, well, instead of just doing that, let's take presuppositions that have good, solid evidence for them and that people claim to know beyond reasonable doubt. And Clark would not allow that. But I would say the law of non-contradiction. I would say the law of causality, the basic reliability of sense experience. I would say all those things we know beyond reasonable doubt. We have much more good evidence with it, for it, than against it, so why reject it? And let's use those quote-unquote self-evident truths as the foundation or the base upon which we build our other knowledge. Now, the rationalist could shortcut the whole deal if he can find things that cannot be denied. To deny it would be a contradiction. And but they don't even want to come to actual undeniability. The actual realm is going to stay in the realm of reason purely, all along.
Is this logically possible that everything, the science and history you just cited, is all a figure of your imagination and you're the only creature that exists?
Yeah. There's no logical contradiction in that at all. I don't want to get off into the ontological argument right now, but see, even when God says, I am who I am, see, we got to make a distinction between existence and essence.
What does ontological mean?
It was just a phrase that Kant termed for that argument, and it just basically means it's an argument solely. Ontological really means being, but he used it as far as it's an argument for God's existence from reason alone, pure reason alone, but. Essence is what something is, and existence is that something is. And philosophers, theologians, define the God of the Bible as a being who's the only being whose essence is his existence. When God says, I am who I am, his essence and existence are both combined. Okay? And the thing is, then when you argue for that in the ontological argument, they would argue that a being whose essence is to exist must exist. It's a contradiction to say a being whose essence is to exist doesn't exist. That's a contradiction. And so this would be another way of saying it is God is defined as a necessary being. A being is defined as a being that cannot not exist. Therefore, it is a contradiction to say that a being that cannot not exist does not exist. Therefore, a necessary being must exist.
Not, that's, but then you, no, I don't want to. Really defining a being as a necessary being doesn't prove that in the actual realm that the necessary being, that there is such a thing as a necessary being.
Well, the thing is, and here's where it comes out, and your accusation has been used against it. And by the way, I'm not defending it, okay. But I'm saying it's a lot stronger than that. Gonolo, when he argued against Anselm, the monk Gonolo, he argued, well, then we can define the first perfect island and say the perfect island therefore must exist. The problem with it is that just in the definition of God, Anselm was arguing existence is a necessary part of that definition. Now, whether he failed or not is a whole different thing. But he's saying it's not an arbitrary definition of God. Even if you're an atheist, if you're trying to refute the God of Christianity, you have to admit, if Anselm is correct, that within the definition of God, existence is necessary there. So, we're not on this point. It opens up a whole other can of worms. But it's like some argued against Descartes. When Descartes used the ontological argument that a triangle is defined as, you know, part of the definition, it has three sides, but that doesn't tell us anything about the triangle existing.
Right.
But Descartes responded, yeah, but existence is not necessary to the definition of a triangle. The three sides are. So if it does, it has to have three sides. But with God, existence is part of the definition. Therefore, God has to exist. So now I'm not saying that that's right. What I'm saying is that they are arguing that part of the definition of God entails no possibility of non-existence.
So the analogy would be that for the triangle, in order to prove the triangle exists, all you have to prove is that three sides do exist. And in order to prove that God exists, all you have to prove is that something exists.
No. In the definition of a triangle, part of that definition includes the three sides that it has to have, no more, no less. But that even though that is true by definition, it doesn't tell us if a triangle exists.
Right.
But what Descartes is saying, though, is just like a triangle must have three sides, God, by definition, must have existence.
So by the definition of God, the fact that we have... The fact that things do exist makes the existence of God necessary by his definition.
Yeah, well, this will be the closing thing I say here because we need to get back into the other thing, but it's just that Norman Malcolm put it this way, if it is possible, in other words, if it's not impossible for God to exist, if it is possible for a necessary being to exist, then he must exist because there's no other way for a necessary being to exist. Other than having necessary existence.
But then you have to ask the question, well, is it a necessary being? I mean, otherwise you're assigning something to something just by definition, when in actuality it might not be true.
If we merely label...
These guys
slap a label on something and use that as a
argument. And that is used, and you're arguing from a Kantian slant. I'm not saying that's wrong. Geisler does too. I do for the most part. But all I'm saying is these guys are saying that just from the idea of God, when the theist and the atheist agrees on the idea of God, it's a contradiction to say that that idea does not have objective existence. Now, whether that's true or not is a whole other can of worms. Kant is saying that we are slipping in existence. But some of the things that Kant says to prove that point scare me. Clark does too. Clark says that to say something is, says nothing. So Clark gets away. I don't want to get too deep.
Saying something is discussing existence, but not what it is. Which is where you're talking about the difference between existence and essence.
Yeah, but the same.
But in order for something to have essence, it must have existence.
Yeah, but see, now you're waffling. Now you're moving back more towards ontological. Mm-hmm. Just in the is. I don't want to get too far into it, but Kant and Gordon Clark would say that if you say Phil Fernandez is, that is a non-statement. It doesn't say anything. Because you have to say he is something. Now, what they do, Kant began
to
do
with Phil Fernandez is the same thing as saying Phil Fernandez has existence.
Well, see, but now you're preventing me from explaining Kant, because you're saying things Kant wouldn't say. Well, what I'm saying, there's some people that you have to put an attribute at the end that is itself, existence itself alone is not an attribute. There's two types of ontological arguments. We're getting way off track. Let's wait till we get there. We're probably, in philosophy of religion, I was going to spend a whole lecture on the ontological argument. I don't think we're going to be able to in this thing. Let's not even get there. We're arguing categories right now that are beyond our level. And I'll be honest with you, the ontological argument, you can blow it off and giggle at it. I do not think it's valid, but I refuse to giggle at it.
Because
there are minds much greater than the minds in this room. There are minds much greater than Norman Geisler. Aquinas did not like it. Thought it was useless. But that's because he was consistent with his Aristotelian philosophy. Had Plato given it some thought, Plato might have bought it, because Plato argued from the realm of ideas. Let's push that off, and we'll get to it later and all. But the fact is, David Hume said that since it's conceivable or rationally possible that nothing exists, the existence of the external world is not certain. If Hume is right, we are only left with probable knowledge, okay? To give you an idea, what Hume said, since the sun rises every morning, that says nothing about tomorrow morning. Therefore, we can never be certain that the sun will rise tomorrow. But since it's risen all throughout the past, it will probably rise tomorrow. And I think that's where I key on probable knowledge. Now, somebody says, well, so you're saying you can only know that God exists with a high degree of probability. Yeah, but I only know that I exist with a high degree of probability. So it doesn't really scare me. I mean, we have fallible minds, so it's always possible that we could be wrong on something, okay? But by the way, though, if that being is non-being type of thing, if that came out to be valid, if that was a valid move from nothing exists to being is non-being, then that would open up the door for, in fact, there's a lot of leading thinkers today that are resurrecting the ontological argument, but we'll get to that later. So our knowledge about the external world, I would say it's probable knowledge, and I would just leave it at that. Self-awareness, another type of knowledge. Self-awareness. That means, knowledge of your own. Knowledge of the self by the self. Arguments for the certainty of self-assurance, René Descartes. Try to doubt everything, but the more he doubted, the more he recognized the existence of the doubter. So he said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. John Locke argued that every time we think, we become conscious of our own existence. However, others have argued against the certainty of self-awareness. Gilbert Ryle said that we can never fully describe ourselves. We don't know and can't remember everything about ourselves. It's a tough one. I would, Geisler would go to the realm of actual undeniability, but even the realm of actual undeniability, Geisler would admit, is not certainty. It's about as high a degree of probability as you can get without certainty. But, some rationalists would argue, but even if I was deceived, about my own existence, there would have to still exist the I to be deceived. So therefore, I can't be deceived about my own existence. Kant would say that we can know the world as it appears to us, but we can't know the world as it actually does exist. We have no way of knowing that. So maybe he would take that into some type of self-awareness. Logical and mathematical knowledge. This type of knowledge is probably one of the few types that you can get mathematical and logical knowledge. Argument for certain knowledge in these areas. Many philosophers believe this knowledge is true in every possible world. I agree with them. The denial of these truths involves a contradiction. Things like 1 plus 1 equals 2.
That's because everything's based on definition.
Yeah. And if you define 1 and 1 and 2, if you define 1 and 2 in the same way in every possible world, it's always going to have to equal 1 plus 1 will always equal 2. The denial of these truths involves a contradiction. Now, objections to this certain knowledge in these areas, so I'll hold the questions for a couple minutes when we'll be done this lecture, just a couple minutes. Objections to certain knowledge in these areas, some believe their truth depends on their form alone. Logic tells us what is possible and impossible. Logic cannot tell us what is actual. Even Geisler and myself would even be in this camp to a certain degree. Logic and math tell us nothing about the world. And that's where we can know things true by definition, but it doesn't tell us anything about the actual world. And John Stuart Mill said, just because we can't conceive of another set of logical laws doesn't make this other set impossible. Another philosopher named Quine said, even those beliefs we hold with greatest certainty could be given up. I would see, though, the laws of